Okay, so today is, let's just say what today is, right? Today is October 10th, 2011, the 12th of Tishrei, 5772, and we're dedicating the Shi'ur to the Le'iloi Nishmat
Michal
Ben Baruch. Okay, so we're going to go through a lot of these. This I decided to do as a chunk because I don't know that much about it. That's the truth, and I'd like to learn more. But so I'm the clear definition of an Am Haaretz that we discussed earlier in a shiur, that I really don't know all this stuff about. This is all Tumantara stuff, and also because it's all kind of blechy things about discharges and things, you know, so we don't want to dwell on that too much.
Right.
So we're just going to go quickly through some of this stuff. So we'll go through each one. Okay, so the precept of offering the offering of a metzorah when he is healed. So after a metzorah, which means somebody who has tzara'as, tzara'at, that's what they're called. So tzara'at is the ailment. Metzorah is the person with the ailment, page 255. So after he's healed from tzara'at, so he's already been, it's been identified, you know, there's this whole process. It's been identified, he's been segregated. For 7 days, he's hopefully done tshuva properly, and he's been checked on after 7 days, and maybe re-separated for 7 more days if he hasn't done proper tshuva, or if he has, then he comes back.
Well, how do they know?
By the way it looks. Mm-hmm. It's a miraculous manifestation on the skin.
I see. Okay. So right, miraculously goes away if you do it properly.
This is all miraculous stuff, as you'll see when we go through it, particularly when we look about the house a little bit. This is totally miraculous. It has nothing to do with, it's a physical manifestation of a spiritual ailment.
I remember that.
Right, so it has nothing to do with physical. So the Kohen is the one who looks at it, and he's trained in seeing physical manifestations of spiritual ailments. And so he will say, it looks like you haven't done proper tshuva because I see that it's not properly healed. The physical manifestation is letting me know that tshuva hasn't been done yet. There are some people around today who can do slightly, a little drop of that today. Some Kabbalists.
I think Rabbi Kagan, I thought he had some knowledge.
He's a Kohen.
You're right.
But, which is possible that he can, but there are some people who today could look at you or see your face and say, oh, looks like you haven't been careful in shatnas. You better check your garments or something like that. There are some people who can see some things like that. Now, not a lot, but it's possible still today that somebody could. So it wouldn't be by looking at a blemish on your skin. It would really be looking at some kind of physical, maybe your aura, some
kind
of physical manifestation of your energy.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, that they could see that, but that people who could read energies that way could see that an energy flow, because that's what it is. An energy flow is not flowing properly because of something physical, because the energy and the physical are connected. That's why we're here in physical bodies, embodied physically. Our spiritual selves is physically embodied, so what we do physically can permit or restrict spiritual energy flows. So somebody who could see the energy flow could say, oh, I see the spiritual, the physical cause of that might be X, Y, or Z. So this is an interesting thing. There's 4 people that are called Mechusar Kapara, Mechusar Kapara, lacking in atonement. And all 4 of them have to bring an offering in order to complete their atonement. Of course, there's lots of different people that have to bring offerings after they complete whatever processes, but these are 4. So one is the Metzorah, one is the Zav, one is the Zava, and one is the Yoledet. Those are the 4 Mechusarei Kapara. So the Metzorah is the one who is now, well, hopefully in the end of the process, now he's healed from his tzara'at, or her tzara'at. Metzorah can refer to either male or female. It would be metzorah, metzara'at. But that general category refers to both. Then we have zav and zava, which is also male and female, relating to those who have flows, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then a yoledet, a woman who gives birth. So there's 2 males and 3 females in the 4 categories, right? Mm-hmm. So a zav and a metzorah could be male. A metzorah could be a female. A zava, a female. And a yoledet, a female. Yeah. Okay, so but each one is different. So that's why you could say, he says in this mitzvah, why don't you just talk about all four together? And they're bringing the offerings at the end of all four. They're one category. He says there may be one category called Mechusar Kapara, but there are four different ailments and four different offerings, so it's four different precepts.
Gotcha.
Okay, so you have to bring that offering at the end. Now, the ritual uncleanness of a house contaminated with tzarat. So this is a very interesting thing, and this does show that... before I go into this one, I just want to point out one thing that's interesting that I don't know enough about. I do want to ask about this concept in the mitzvah just above. So on page 257, just at the end of that mitzvah, it says in the middle of the second to the end, for this reason the sages rules that a man may bring an offering for his young sons and daughters. Oh, above that, that you can, this is one atonement in this category, this whole category of all four of these, is an atonement that you can bring on behalf of somebody else without their knowledge, and then just feed that person the meat of the doesn't require their consent or knowledge. They don't have, so it's an interesting thing. I don't understand how that works, but that you
Mormons converting us,
live deal, but but it is something that right. So it's interesting that.
But it says young sons and daughters, so maybe it has to do with them being sort of not of age.
Maybe, so they could, but they have to be, have age enough to have committed the Avera.
Which requires some,
and some kind of tshuva over it. Right? Because otherwise, how are you healed from it?
It says that they were lacking in atonement, too. Like,
well, lacking in atonement.
Well, but didn't do tshuva.
No. Lacking in atonement in this case specifically means you didn't complete the process by bringing the korban. In this case, that's what these four things are.
So
this category.
Right, they have to be of a certain age.
Right. They have to have enough knowledge to have been able to transgress.
Of course, definitions of young have changed. So.
Right. So what does that mean? And is that the halachic katan? Because it says, banav uvnotav haktanim. But what does that mean? Katan halachically, meaning pre-bar bat mitzvah? Or katan just they're young, maybe before 20, which is bar onshim. Like, who knows what that means?
Right.
I don't know. So I do want to ask about that. That's part of my tshuva for this year. I said I have to start learning earlier so I can ask questions earlier so I don't come to class not knowing something. It's ridiculous. So, that's my... You're not supposed to say your sins out loud, so that's enough of that.
I keep coming back.
So anyway. So... The ritual uncleanness of a house contaminated with tzarat infection. So this one,
weird.
It is weird, but this is where it proves that this is 100% spiritual, has nothing to do with physicality. And Rav Hirsch has an interesting thing to talk about also. So this is where a house might require shutting up or demolition of some of its walls or the entire house. That's what you do to a house that has tzarat in it. Right? So, but it can only be a house in the land of Israel, in the portioned territory, not in Jerusalem because it's not apportioned. Right? So only in the land of Israel, A. And only in land that's been given to a specific tribe, B. And only a private dwelling, C. So it can't be a municipal dwelling, you know, the courthouse of the area of God. Can't get it. God meaning G-A-D, not G-O-D. Right, or Don, or whatever. It can't be, so it can't be a tribal building, it has to be a municipal building, it has to be a private dwelling within apportioned land in the land of Israel, so Jerusalem doesn't count. And then it has to be built of certain materials, and not of other materials. So only if it's built of those materials, and not other materials, and only if it's in the land of Israel, and only if it's in apportioned territory, and only if it's a private dwelling, can it get this affliction. And then the affliction comes in different colors, and it would have to be seen by a Kohen. When you see it, this is interesting, in terms of koach hadibur, the power of our speech, we have to be careful because the Kohen has to pronounce it tzaras or not. So we're not permitted. We can't say, oh, looks like there's tzaras in my house. Or, oh, look what you got, a case of tzaras over there in the corner. We're not allowed to say that. You could say, it looks like there's something that looks like tzaras in your corner. But you can't say it is. That's for a Kohen to say. We're not allowed to diagnose. So you could say, it looks like you should call a Kohen, looks like there's something suspicious. So you could say that, but you can't say, you're not allowed to say what it is. Because you don't know. I mean, it's up to the Kohen to say it. So we do have this concept in Jewish law, the interaction of the human, that there has to be that interaction in order to create the halachic reality. So one has to see it in order to make it so, even if it is so. So, for instance, in a very dark private house made of the right materials in the private a private house in the apportioned lands in the land of Israel. But if you can't see it because it's too dark in the house, it can't be tzarat. You have to be able to see it. So that happens with some other things too, for sure with Nida, right? So you have to check some things with Nida, but some things if you don't see it,
it's not there.
Because it really, it's not that you're faking it, it's that the halacha requires the engagement of the human being in the process. And without that engagement, it doesn't happen. So for instance, that's one reason why you're supposed to wear colored underwear during your tahor time, so you can't see a spot. And that's one reason why you're supposed to check at the end of your period with a white cloth, because you have to see that it's over. If you don't check, it's not over. You have to see that it's over. So there does have to be engagement in order to create the reality of the halacha in certain cases. So this is one of those cases. A kohen has to come in and see it. You have to call the kohen, but that's laws we don't need to learn today because it's not our situation, sadly, but hopefully someday we'll get back to a place where there are physical manifestations of spiritual ailments so that we would know sooner so that we could take care of it. As I read this stuff, I just wonder, like, oh my gosh, people had to be so careful all the time. We're so lazy all the time because
it
just...
It seems to me if you were spending all of your time doing that, how did you even, like...
Plow a field.
No, I think you did plow a field because you were just, you had a much more heightened awareness of everything. Mm-hmm. So you were just more careful. I mean, people might say, how could you possibly drive a car and navigate? You have to pay so much attention to the road and all the details and the speed of the car. Right, but the point is once you learn how to drive, it's different than driving a wagon, right? But you've acquired all those skills and now they're part of you. So now you can drive and navigate.
It was easier because you didn't have to check heftures. You grew everything.
Right. I mean, yeah, so,
the,
yeah.
I mean, the only thing you had to worry about was the...
Everything else.
Was the shoyfet who killed your meat, and you probably did it yourself.
Right. Do you know the story I heard from Yul Unger yesterday? Rabbi Unger?
I guess not.
Oh, yeah, the story of the farmer, right? So the farmer, he lives out in the sticks. And he's an Erlich Hayid. He raises his own chickens, his own crops and everything. And every once in a while, the shoyfet comes and he kills a chicken. And, you know, if there's a Shiloh with a chicken, it's a real hassle because now he has to get on the wagon and hitch up the team and go into town and find the rabbi, and the rabbi has to look and rule. And maybe it's kosher, maybe it's treif, and they just ride all the way back home and then either dispose of the chicken or eat it. Right, so it's kind of a hassle. One day a leitz, a scoffer, comes to visit the farmer, and he says, oh, what are you doing? You're hooking up your wagon. It's so much work. He says, the pasuk says to the dogs, they should cast your treif meat. Why don't you let the dog decide? You just put the chicken in front of the dog. If the dog eats it, it's treif. And if he doesn't eat it, it's kosher. He says, well, that's a good idea. It's so much work going into town. So the first next Shiloh, he puts in front of the dog. Now the dog knows he's not allowed to eat his master's chicken, so he sniffs it and he walks away. And he says, great, it's kosher. And he eats it. And then the next Shiloh comes up and he puts it in front of the dog. And the dog is thinking, what's he giving me again? By the third time already, the dog catches on. He eats the whole chicken. He says, okay, I guess that one was treif. Fourth time, eats the chicken. Fifth time, he's like, I'm losing so many chickens now. Finally, a few months later, the next Shiloh, he hooks up the team and he goes into the rabbi. And he asks the rabbi, the Shiloh. And the rabbi says, oh, I haven't seen you in a while. Where have you been? He says, well, you know, I had this new method of the dog checking, and it was working out okay at first, but now, like, it's just, he said, why'd you stop with that? He said, well, the dog is such a machmir. He's so strict.
Too strict, that dog.
Right.
Right. Yeah,
so,
okay.
So anybody could be machmir. That's the point of the joke, is that it takes a real chacham to be mekil, to let go. Yeah. Right. Okay. So anyway.
Cute.
Right. So it's interesting to see a dark house. We see that does not become defiled for the affection, because if you can't see it, it's not it. Okay, and likewise, houses that they have to be made of certain things, bricks and marble, are not considered as stones. So I thought that was interesting because Jerusalem is made largely out of Jerusalem marble. It's called shayish, although it's probably not real marble.
Yeah,
it's called shayish.
Kind of
it is a particular thing. Although in Jerusalem, tzarat can't come anyway.
Right.
Right. Right. But it does have to be specifically those kinds of things, which show you that it has nothing to do with anything physical. Because if it was something physical, you could like any mildew, material. It could be any material in any place and any time, and you could say, get out of that house, destroy that wall. This is a physical thing, and you need to protect yourself from mold, which today in Jerusalem, there's mold everywhere, unfortunately. It's really awful. Yeah, I mean, and all around, not just Jerusalem. Tzfat, for sure, because it's much moister. So moldy there. It's really a problem.
Is it people with allergies. Dangerous, bad?
Yeah.
Is that bad for
it is. Yeah, it's bad for
allergies.
It's really bad for people.
That would be a good business, is mold abatement.
It is. It's interesting how people have different sensibilities, like, for instance, with lice. So once my kids got lice, and Israeli lice, that was the first time it put a little quash on my desire to make aliyah, because it took 3 months of contending with it to finally get rid of the last one. It was awful. They just, because they're Israeli lice, so they just laughed in the face of Rid. I poured chemicals on my kid's head, and they just looked at me like, you think that's going to work on us? Yeah. You know, we're Israeli.
Oh,
no way. Oh, no, it was just awful. Anyway, so in Israel, they don't send you home from school if you have lice, because so many people have it. Like, it's just a different sensibility. And the same thing with mold. They just, they don't freak out about it.
Because they have a Middle Eastern sensibility.
So they just have, they live with it. Because can you get every drop out of it? No, you can't. So you might as well just live with it. So they do. Right? So they just, it's not at all the mentality that we have.
And for some reason, kids do outgrow it. I mean, my nieces and nephews all had it in preschools.
The lice?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Every day school in
Israel
California
has it.
Yeah.
Kids
and
get it all the time.
They get it, but, you know,
I mean,
it goes through like...
We sort of all have an ick factor with it. And
it's awful. Yeah. It's just awful. We should have an ick factor. Anyway.
We should have a rule about lice.
Right. Okay, Rabbi Hirsch, Rav Hirsch, Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, explains a little bit, which I thought was fascinating, that it comes in private houses to indicate that houses shouldn't be so private. It really comes when people are selfish with their homes and keep their doors closed, right? Because it can only come in apportioned places where this land belongs to you and this house is private, right? So, only to places like that. So when it's become too private, that you're not a house of chesed, that you're not a house of giving, that you're not open enough to others, that you think it's all about you and your house and your closedness, then that's when you can get sarat. Yeah. That it is a physical manifestation of selfishness in a home. And it only appears on the walls, inside the walls of a house, the walls, not the ceiling and not the floor, but the walls, which are the element of the house that isolate. Right, because the roof protects and the floor supports, but the walls cut off the outsiders. So it can only appear on the walls, that part that cuts out the outsiders. So I thought that was a fascinating thing, just to see like part of what the ailment could be, but the ailment of cutting one's house off from the giving to others, that we have to realize that we live in a community and we have a responsibility to the community and a responsibility to bring people into our home and care for them to the extent that we can. But that is part of what Sarat is about, is not having our homes open enough to the outside. Okay, 178. On the ritual uncleanness of a man with a gonorrheal discharge. And it's interesting because these mitzvot, now I'll say it's mitzvat inyan tumat zav lihiyot tameh umitameh. So it's the mitzvah of the idea of, right? So there's no behavior here except for how to act in response to the person who has this, or the person needs to know about himself that he is tamei. That's the mitzvah, that you are tamei and that you can make things tamei. Tamei umitamei, right? So as we learned earlier in a little bit about tuma and tara, that there are certain tumas that are contagious. So here it says a gonorrheal discharge. Is it specifically the disease gonorrhea? I don't think so. However, it's something that looks like it. Right, what do you see here?
Well, and there's a footnote that I just was looking at that sort of makes it sound like it was, but early on they had it confused with a seminal discharge or something involving that.
Well,
in fact, it wasn't.
Right, it's clearly, so they say here, it's not healthy semen, and he gives an example. Here, look at the middle paragraph. In substance, this discharge is something that issues from a man out of the opening of the generative organ as a kind of liquid. And at its emission, he feels neither lust nor pleasure. Our sages of blessed memory taught that it resembles the liquid of dough from barley flour, and it likewise resembles the white of a rotten, unfertilized egg.
Yeah.
Semen, however, is not so, being like the white of a sound, fertilized egg. This, then, is the difference between them, so that one can be distinguished from the other. Right, so it's not just, they didn't confuse it for semen. They knew it was something
different.
Something different and something sick.
Right.
Something bad. Right, so it is interesting to see this here. Right.
Certainly.
Yeah, it is. So it's not necessarily the disease, gonorrhea, but it is.
Something
it's using
similar
that,
to
right.
that.
Yeah, but it goes to the root of the words.
Uh-huh.
Dano, semen, rebo, flow.
Uh-huh. Right, so it's a flow. So.
Yeah.
Right, so this causes, so a seminal, as we'll see in a minute, let's see what mitzvah is that one, 180,
right,
so a discharge of semen by itself, whether it's in, whether it was by mistake or on purpose in sexual relations with one's wife or otherwise, whatever it is, just the discharge of that semen does cause a light tumah. But it's not a tumah, it is tumah v'mit tumah, it's a tumah that also makes things tumah. But this is a heavy tumah. This is a stronger tumah that takes longer. So the seminal discharge, I think, just takes 1 day to get over, and this takes 7 days to get over. So this is a serious discharge. And the discharge, it depends. If there's only one instance of it, if you only see one expression of that fluid that you think is bad, so then it's still a light tumah. Once you see two or three, then you know for sure that it's this. And then you switch into the category of a heavy tumah, so that the way that you deal with it is different. But it's interesting to see that what it is, it's not just, it could be from venereal disease. It's possible that it could be from that. But it also says here it could be from other diseases of lust. So venereal disease is clearly a disease of lust. Because you slept with somebody you shouldn't have slept with, right? And you slept, or you slept with somebody maybe you're permitted to sleep with, but they slept with somebody that they shouldn't have slept with. So you've encountered inappropriate lust, and that's why one gets this. But it could be bigger than that. So look at page 263, at the root of the precept, the second paragraph. First indentation lies the reason that the eternal Lord blesses he removed from us excesses of all types and commanded us to be holy and decent in regard to food and drink. And in all other human activities, there can be no doubt that this matter of discharge will happen to a person when he persistently leaves the straight and decent path in this, in his eating and drinking, amassing in his body as a result that putrid, abhorrent, unclean excess. So this is also
I know that, like, if you succumb to drinking too much, you could do things that aren't wise.
No, I think this is about no. I don't think so. No, I think this is about this is still a physical manifestation of a spiritual ailment.
Okay.
That's what's important to see. This is not being physically sick. It's not just getting. That's why I wanted to distinguish it from gonorrhea. So it is going to the root of the word in Latin, but it's not just that you got a venereal disease. Is that there is a venereal expression of a spiritual ailment, which is the ailment of going to excess in things. So excess,
not necessarily
sexual activity, right? Could be eating and drinking. So gluttony in all its forms, lustfulness in all its forms, going too much to the physical can lead to this spirit, to this expression. So whereas metzora is produced by speaking negatively about others, this is produced by your
by actions.
You're following your negative desires or going too far in the physical realms. It will express itself there in that physical place. So it is a different kind of a thing. It's still a physical expression of a spiritual malady. Right. Okay, now 179 on the offering by a man with a gonorrheal discharge when he's healed. So that's where you might think that this should be connected with 176, right, on the offering of a metzora, right, but it's separate because it's a different type of offering. Each one is its own thing. But the significance of the offering is to hint at the degradation of the body's desiring inclination and exaltation of the spirit of intelligence. And the exaltation of the spirit of intelligence, right? Not exaltation. right. Thus, when a man with a discharge is cured, it is fitting for him to realize the evil of his craving and set his body straight with all his power by the significance of the offering. However, And this is what's strange, so I have it flagged to ask. The laws of the precepts are, for example, when the sages of blessed memory taught that the offering of one lacking in atonement does not need the knowledge and consent of its person. Mm-hmm. How does that work, is my question, right? Because here you have...
The offering of one lacking in atonement does not need the knowledge...
Or consent of the person. Yeah, so we saw with the Metzorah, right?
Yeah, same concept.
Right? So we saw with the Metzorah, and we see here, too, that the Mechuse Kapara, this category of four, does not require the knowledge of the person who's Mechusar Kapara to work. All you have to do is bring it. So there is, in a way, Lahavdil, but in a way, some type of, I don't know if the right word is magic, but some type of element. Somebody else can bring it for the person without the person even knowing.
And it works. Well, and that sort of seems contrary to the whole idea of tshuva.
Or free will.
Yes, it does.
Well, but tshuva more than that even, because tshuva requires an awareness and a, you know, intentional training and all of those things. And you can see the sacrifice as being the culmination of all of that, sort of the end point. And if you haven't done it, to say, well, I can do it for you, then that's sort of...
Right, that's my question. Yeah, that's a very big question, I think.
That's
huge. Very big question.
But
you have a duty
to... Maybe the wife would know, and then she was doing it on the basis of Shalom Bayit.
And not just that. The wife has to know, but so does everybody else in temple times. Have to, because it's a tamei umitamei.
So they can't...
It causes tamei. So they, if they sit on something, that thing becomes tamei, and if you sit on it, you become tamei.
Or if you were next to them and touched them.
Or a bed, or a hammock, or a... Yeah, not just... I don't think touching.
Not touching.
But if they... Anything that's meant to support a human being, if they use it as support, becomes something that can then be matame somebody else. So support a human being would be something that you sit on, something that you lie on. So it could be a bench, a couch, a cart, a hammock, a bed, or... No, not the floor, but a commuter strap or pole.
It's meant to... have straps or poles.
No, but they do actually use the word pole here. They use the, he says it in French.
So they had poles.
They had something that helped you be stable, in that stabilized a person.
Okay. Right.
So that thing that would be attached to something that helped a human being.
Not if you sat on the ground.
Not if you sat on the ground,
okay, so
right.
The ground can't.
No, cannot, no. But, right, but something that is meant to support a person.
Okay.
Something that's meant to support a person. So you go into a barrel factory to chat with your friend. And you take one of the barrels and flip it over and sit on it. That is not, it is supporting, but it's not meant to support a person.
Ah.
That barrel does not become tummy. Because, and it says that the way you know is because the person might say, get up already, I have to get back to work, right? You need that barrel now. So that's not a chair for the person. You can take it back and it's not
metame.
So something that's designed for supporting a person is what can become tame and make other people tame through it. So, but...
How have they cleansed that support?
Good question.
That is a good question.
Yes.
A chair.
Right, it probably...
They can immerse it.
I'm guessing that it disappears after a certain period, but that's why everybody would have to know. That's a good question. I'm going to look into that, too.
That's what I just said, put him in the mikvah.
Right.
Big mikvah.
Right. Right. So that, but that's why somebody who had this
you
would
have
to,
you, have like
you can't, this is not private.
Right.
I mean, nobody has to know why your tummy necessarily, what the thing is,
they have
but
like
they have to know your tummy.
That they wore
yeah, I think they did. They did have to wear some kind of a something. They had to announce, I'm tummy. Right?
That's what I'm saying, like the little scarlet tea.
Yes, scarlet tea. Exactly. You needed something that announced it because other people had to be careful of you. If somebody wanted to bring a korban that evening, they couldn't risk coming near you.
So these mostly were in effect when the temple was there. So it's
right.
Like we have a pretty short window for many of these things when they were really affected and in place for...
Well, so yes and no.
Okay.
Because yes, they're only in effect, the practical application of these halachas is only effect when the temple is in existence. However, we're still tummy from the things today.
So what do you
with no way to...
So, right, so it talks about it in here in the halacha. Ooh, so there's mikvah still. You can't bring a korban, but
right.
There's still mikvah. So that's what it says... here is that you can, even the practice, so today, if you look on page 269, but for our time, it's the middle of the paragraph, but for our time we have the ruling in the Talmud that the sages nullified the need for immersion. So for our time, even though we still could go to the mikveh, which still
you don't
does
even
take
have to go to the mikveh.
You do not. Hence, a man need not refrain now from praying and studying, which during temple times he did. He could, if he was tamei from this, he could not daven or learn Torah. But today he can. Or even for putting on tefillin. So today, which is considered clearly here, higher than praying or studying is putting on tefillin. So even that he's permitted to do today without having gone to the mikvah because on account of pollution, he can do that today.
So would this apply to everything or just this one?
No, all these. This is a concept.
This is okay.
All these as a concept, right. Even the practice of washing. So washing here means washing the body with 9 kavim of water. Tisha kavim. So that's a certain measure that we use, which substitutes in some cases for mikveh immersion. So a shower of a certain amount of minutes, depending on the flow of your water, would work. We use that today when we do taharas. If we don't have a mikveh for the mate, some cities have a mikveh specifically for bodies, but many cities don't. So they substitute the tisha kabim, pouring 9 measures of water over the body. And they're pretty big measures. They're like buckets full of water over it. So we don't...
Do you have a mikveh for them?
Do you know a mikveh for a mate? Do we have a mikveh in Denver? Is there a mikveh for? We just do tisha kabim, right? Yeah.
Well, maybe for the good of the community, this was inserted. That obviously the community couldn't function at that time without everyone having this level of purity. So this was inserted by the sages that whether or not this person or these people that knew or did not know that they were tamei, that there was a clause inserted that someone that knew about this could go and
back to the other point.
Well, so what it's saying...
Bring the offering, just automatically.
Uh-huh. I see what you're saying.
Or it could be done in sort of as part of communal prayer for everyone that had become...
Right, then maybe... I see what you're saying. You're answering the question by saying possibly the principle of Kol Yisrael, Aravim Zelazeh, applies here, that every Jew is tied one to another, so the one Jew could, through the ties, atone for another, or bring that proper...
But then why wouldn't that apply for...
To other things.
I mean, why wouldn't that apply to other things?
Well, it probably has to do with certain levels that you can.
Yeah, because it affects everybody. And in that time, and during the temple times when everything was just, you know, everyone was doing, had this complete level of holiness.
But aren't there other things that affect, that create an impact on other people that we don't have that ability to
right,
sort of
do
it? Right,
but something that's tame umetame, something where somebody is contagious too,
no,
like
no,
you
no,
said,
no, no, that's
specifically.
What I'm
right, it's a good question.
Does this concept apply to all those things?
Right.
I know it applies to these particular ones because
right.
we just read it.
But does not seem, I haven't seen it apply to other
that's
things
what
yet.
I was asking.
But it doesn't mean I've seen everything.
No, that's
so that's, yeah, it's a good question.
Well,
it's a good thought. Yeah,
that?
Yes, I'm going to learn, I'll learn more about it.
This whole concept
yeah,
of,
yeah, yeah. That, it's fascinating.
It's a
yeah.
good idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I think,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that concept makes
just
a lot
let
of
these
sense.
Things just sit.
That
know?
Concept makes
yeah.
a lot of sense, but then it would seem that it would apply
broad.
To anything that.
We should be able to do kapara one for another then.
That could affect another person.
Right.
Because it puts the responsibility on man to do the work, but obviously
right.
he can't do it.
Right.
God is the backup via Kol Yisrael in a way.
But this doesn't
sure.
say he can't do it.
Well,
right, just
maybe,
that somebody else can do it for them.
Yeah, but maybe this guy is, you know, a slough, you know.
Right, it might be. So, well, right, it's not clear. It doesn't say a reason why they're not.
Right.
Right, it doesn't say why they're not. So it's interesting to see.
That's very interesting.
Right.
And the question is, I think, would it apply to any, or does it?
Can it?
Could it?
Right.
Apply to any...
I mean, it certainly does a little bit. We say chatanu
lifanecha.
I mean, we just spend the whole Yom Kippur.
Right. It's involving the entire community.
Right. So it does.
He's holding the community hostage for his inability to.
Possibly, right.
Korban.
So it does apply, it does apply today a little bit, certainly, when we say in the plural, chatanu lifanecha on Yom Kippur. Even if I didn't do that sin, I'm confessing for the sake of my brethren who did.
Right.
Right. And it could be that we did in some way. I was thinking about that.
Knowing about it.
Well, so I was thinking about it, for instance, with, I don't know if I mentioned in this class, but I mentioned in another class I know about this. I did a team teaching with a sex therapist on intimacy. And so I first gave information on the Jewish point of view, and she gave practical application. But she went way too far, way past where it was Jewishly permissible at all. And yet I was a part of it. I didn't teach that, but I was there. And she taught things that were usser. So what's my culpability? I thought about when I said, Al chet shechatanu begilui arayot, on the sin that we committed with revealing with sexual immorality. Right, so I personally wasn't sexually immoral this year. You know, I was with my husband only. Mm-hmm. However, I was involved in something that did advocate for totally inappropriate sexual relations.
In front of a Jewish group?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to say it at the end?
I did say it then, but it wasn't enough. It was not enough.
It was already out there.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Mm. It was definitely already out there.
You obviously didn't know this therapist.
No, I had no clue. No clue what she was going to say. No, and we had talked before, so I thought I had a clue.
You thought you had a clue.
I thought I did, but I had no clue she was going to go there at all.
Was it in response to a question, or
yeah.
Did somebody else bring it up?
Yeah, how do you keep things interesting? So when she said certain answers, I was like, no, no, you can't do that. No, no, no. So, yeah. So anyway, so I think with that, but we say achay chachatanu in the plural because I'm helping confess for somebody else's adultery or sleeping around, right?
Whatever.
But also for my own participation on whatever level that I shouldn't have participated. I should have been much more careful with that person, mm-hmm. you know, making sure that we were clear on what was going to be shared in front of a group like that. So so it could be a sin on your level, or it could be the sin that's written up straight up there. Anyway, so we do have that concept of communal working together, so we'll have to ask if that's what's applying here. Anyway, I just want to point out at the bottom of this paragraph, however, if a spiritual person purifies himself of his pollutions even today, meaning those people who go to the mikvah on a regular basis, it is good and praiseworthy way of behavior for him, and blessing will be bestowed upon him. Then whoever knows the way of purity and its manifest goodness, let him hold fast to it. So even though it doesn't apply today, he's saying whoever still has
anyway.
This thing, keep doing it. This is important. We need that in this world. Those don't give that up. Okay. 181, the precept of the ritual uncleanness of a menstruant. Now, we're going to go into this much more deeply when we get to Mitzvah 207, which is several pages long. So this is just one little quick paragraph, just the idea that somebody is tamei and mitame when they go into Nida. That's this whole mitzvah. It's not about what the negative concept of having sex with a menstruant. It's just the positive concept of that she's tamei and mitame, so that she causes tumah. And that's enforced every place and every time if someone violates it or does not deal with her as in a state of tumah. And so too, if she conducts herself in a way of ritual purity, meaning if she eats from kodshim, she eats from the holy offerings or things like that, then she, not even talking about if she sleeps with somebody that she shouldn't sleep with, but just if she behaves in a way of ritual purity or if somebody doesn't deal with her in a state of ritual impurity, then they've disobeyed this positive commandment. Okay, 182. On the ritual uncleanness of a woman with an irregular discharge. So this is Zav, because there's Zav and Zava. Did we deal with Zav already? Yep. So it's interesting. This is different. So Zav and Zava, even though Zava is the feminine of Zav, they're two separate categories. We know that from the actual discharge color itself. Because if a man's strange discharge is red, he's not a Zav. And if a woman's strange discharge is white, she's not a Zava, right? A man's has to be white, and a woman's has to be red, right? So it's a different ailment. If it was the same, if Zav and Zava was the same, then they would both be the same looking discharge. So they're different discharges, so they're different ailments. So even though they have the same name, they're different categories. Which is why it's listed as four. Mitzora is one category, male or female. Zav and Zav are two separate categories. Okay, so this is an interesting thing. So he goes into it at length because he talks about when can that strange discharge happen. It can only happen in an 11-day window following the 7 days of her period. Following the seven, so not counting the 7 clean days, which today is the universal custom of all Jewish women to wait a minimum of 5 days for their period and 7 clean days after their period. But the biblical thing to do is to wait 7 days from the beginning of their period till the end, immersing on the 8th day. So that's a biblical thing. So, and that's whether the period's 3 days or 7 days. If the period's 8 days, then you'd have to wait the next day. But it's from the beginning of the period until the end of a 7-day period, and then after that, done, Right, so now,
come
we added on seven clean, so that has to do with this. And so we're not sure today what is a zav, and what is a zava, and what is a nida. A zava has to wait 7 days from the end of her zavik emission.
Affliction.
So that is the rule for a zava. She has to wait 7 days from the end of her discharge until she can go to the mikveh, a 7-day period. Today, it seems that we're not totally certain what is the emission that we're seeing. Or could it be both? Could it be menstruation and zava? So since we're not 100% clear all the time today, we took upon ourselves a stringency that we would wait 7 days from the last sign of blood in case that last sign of blood happened to not be menstruation but happened to be zava. So we have a 7-day waiting period. That's why we do that.
So it's because this is really something different.
This is something different. It's a different thing with a different law. So we keep both laws every month.
All together.
Right, both laws together. So it's not just the biblical waiting till the end of the period and then 7 days total from the beginning of the period till the end of the time. It's from the end of the period.
Count seven.
You count 7 days as if the last day of the period might have been zava.
Ah, okay.
So that's why we wait.
It could be technically 2 weeks.
Yeah,
it is.
Exactly.
It usually is. It's 12 days. It's usually 12 days. Because you count from the... Because you're for sure covered with the biblical thing about Nida by waiting the 7 extra days. So you don't have to wait 7 days plus 7 days. You wait 5 days plus 7 days.
Depends on how long.
Because the first...
how long your period is.
Well, so 5 is the minimum. Mm-hmm. So even if your period's only 3 days, you still have to wait 5 before you can start counting the 7.
Oh, 5 is the minimum.
Yeah, 5 is the minimum. But it's not the maximum. So if your period is 6 days, you wait 6 days and then you count the 7. Right. So, but 5 is the minimum. For those people, just parenthetically, for those people... Right. But just, it's important to know, little bits and pieces.
Well, women that have irregular periods, because it's really hard.
Right, so that's hard. Well, so that's just about counting in anticipation is the difficulty. The challenge with the minimum of 5 days is for those who experience what's called halachic infertility. Okay. So those who have short cycles where they might be ovulating during those 7 days. So those 7 days are so strong. We keep them so much that we don't shorten them, even for halachic infertility. However, what we might shorten is the 5-day minimum. So if a woman's period really is only 3 days, then she might, if she's experiencing halachic infertility and asks a shayla, then she might be told she can count just the 3 days of her period and then the 7 clean days. Not count 5 days, but just, but the 7 days is counted. That's very strong today, and that's not abridged. I don't know. Somebody might.
If you have a 3-day period, you're out of luck with that.
With the halachic infertility, but you might not be halachically infertile if
you get older.
Right. But you might not be halachically infertile with the if you have the longer period, because it means your cycle is longer. But somebody who has a short cycle, that's the problem. You know, somebody who has, let's say, a 24-day cycle or instead of a 28-day cycle, that's their problem, is they're ovulating earlier. anyway. So where do we go here? Right. So that's the zava, is the one who has a discharge in that 11-day period. So he goes on at length here. So from the end of the 7 days, there's an 11-day period where we don't expect the menstruation to return. Right? So during that 11 days, there's a halachic ruling that that's not menstruation. If you see blood during the 11 days, following the 7 days, not the 7 clean days, following the 7 biblical days, those 11 days, if you see blood, then it's a zava. So, but after that, if you don't, the 11-day period doesn't begin again until after one's period. So let's say somebody has very long cycles, or somebody's nursing, or pregnant, or whatever it is. After that 11-day period has passed, then the next blood is considered nida, until a nida, actual menstruation, has occurred. And then after that, the 11 days can start again. But it's not, and he says, some people have made mistakes. He explains this. Some people have made mistakes and count 7, 11, 7, 11, 7, 11, wondering if in any of those 11s it could be a zava. And he says, that's not the case. It's 7, 11, and then it could only be menstruation, not
so
zava.
So if a person, for example, had irregular bleeding and bled in the middle of a cycle, like after 15 days.
Right.
Just a little tiny bit.
Right, then, so that's when you go to a Rav and ask a Shaila.
I was going to say, then that's like, whoa.
Right, and that's why you want to be super careful. That is why, because of the engagement of seeing it, that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. So you're not supposed to look.
You're not supposed to look.
You're supposed to have colored underwears because you can't really see. Even if you do see a spot, you don't really know what color that spot is. Is that red or not?
Mm-hmm. Right? If you haven't seen it, it's...
If you haven't seen it, is not, right? But that's the halachic reality. If you haven't seen that red spot of a certain size, you're not Anita. So that's why you wear a colored underwear. And then also you're not supposed to check the toilet either and see something that might cause a question. So you're just not supposed to look. So, but there are sometimes when it doesn't matter if you looked or not, you could tell. So then you ask a Shaila what to do. But that's what Rabbanim are for. I mean, there are certain people who are very good at answering those shilas. And when I first got married, I thought, I will never, ever ask a shila like that. No way. Right? And I was not counseled properly before I got married and how important it is to ask shilas. But it is very important. And it's just like going to, I mean, today we have mostly female OBGYNs. But for us older people, which is everybody in this room, we've all experienced male OBGYNs. And
still do.
And just, I mean, it's just like talking to a doctor that way. It's not necessarily your local Rav, although it might be, but it's somebody who knows this area and you can talk to him about this area. It's not that uncomfortable.
Like not personal, sorry.
It's a little bit, but it's not like your rabbi. How could you possibly? It's a professional who knows this area and it's fine. You can bring him a spot and have him check it and he'll tell you.
Yes or no,
this is fine, or it looks like you have a yeast infection, or you need to get checked out, or it looks like this might be an injury, or whatever it is. They can see by the colors what it is. So, go.
I'm glad I'm old.
Pays to ask.
There are some benefits here.
Pays to ask. Well, you can have your husband ask, or you can drop off envelopes. Yeah. Like sometimes you just put the spot, whatever it is, in an envelope, and you put your phone number on it. So in big communities, you don't even put your name on it. You just put your initials on the envelope with your phone number. Now,
when they call,
he probably knows. But or it could be email, right?
Yeah, now
it could be
email
or texting, right? So you don't have to talk if you don't want to. But you know, if you're brave enough or if you're over that, depending on how sensitive you are, right? But and usually you're supposed to put like the circumstances of finding it on there. Sometimes they need to call you and say, what happened? How did this happen? Because that makes a difference too. But in general, you know, they're very straightforward. It's not that big a deal. Okay, good. We're almost at the end here, right? 183. Okay. On the offering by a woman with an irregular. Nope.
No.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, that is it.
Did I skip one?
No. Well, the seminal. Yeah,
no,
you did.
Yeah, I did.
You skipped the seminal fluid.
Oh, yeah, I did. Okay, good.
You did.
Irregular discharge. Let's just go over this.
183.
When she recovers, 183. Okay, so we did that one. So when she recovers, she has to bring a carbon. And on the ritual uncleanness of seminal fluid, 180.
Yeah,
okay, thank you. Okay, so if any time a flow of seed goes out from a man, on purpose or by mistake, there is a light defilement that happens. Now, this is also a question for me, and I don't fully understand, so I also flagged this just for additional questions. So at the bottom of the page, this last paragraph, the uncleanness of semen is in effect in every place and every time. However, now that for our sins we have neither sanctuary nor holy offerings, we do not need to be careful in regard to the ritual uncleanness. Nevertheless, Ezra instituted a rule of ritual immersion for those who have pollutions. So it's called tumah every time, right? So they should be more cleansed and pure in their thought, and people should not be so frequently with their wives like roosters.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, why is it like roosters? Is that because the egg needs to be fertilized? So they're, you know, and a rooster has many wives? Who knows? Why is that? But I'm curious about why that specifically is used.
And we did talk about this part.
And it does say here, since conjugal intimacy is as defiling as a pollution. So even conjugal intimacy, even appropriate, but just the emission of semen from a man, is metame. It causes a tumah.
But once it enters a woman, then it isn't. Is that right? I mean...
No, it actually is. So there's a tumah called shechvat zera, the zera leaving. So both the man and the woman have that because he has it from his seminal emission. She has it from his zera leaving her.
Right. So
So they both have it. So if we understand this, and again, I want to check, but my understanding currently of tumah in general, this type of tumah, is a brush of, it's easiest to say a brush of death, but let's just say it in the positive sense, a brush of loss of life potential.
Right, opportunity.
Right,
potential.
Right, mm-hmm. Life potential. So when the zera leaves the body, life potential has left him.
And
it's gone into his wife. And similarly, if it leaves her body, so life potential has left her. So, but it's a lighter tumah than when her egg leaves her.
Which is nida.
Right, which is nida, which is a much longer tumah. This is a one-day tumah. That's a seven-day tumah.
So.
But it's still a tumah.
Okay.
Yeah, still a tumah.
Are you supposed to go to the mikveh every time you have relations?
Yes, so that's what this is saying. So, in temple times, yes. In temple times,
you
yes.
You don't have relations that often because you're not like a rooster.
Right.
Then
you have 2 weeks.
Right.
You have to do it every 2 weeks.
Right. Oh, no. So, it would be once a day. Mikveh once a day.
Limited to once a day.
Yeah, it'd be limited to once a day. Yeah.
Okay.
Because
whatever. Okay.
We'll skip that. Right. I don't need to go there. But it'd be a once a day thing. Right. Because
only for 2 weeks, though.
Only for the time on.
Because for 2 weeks, you're not.
Mm-hmm. Well, so newlyweds often get pregnant right away, so then they have that whole first year together.
Yeah.
but anyway, it would be every time in order to be able to do certain things. So certainly going to the temple, eating from sacrifices, eating from holy produce, from certain tithes and things like that,
right.
You would have to go to the mikvah after marital relations. So there's so many different ways to become tameh. You're not like broadcasting to the world.
Time.
I mean, you kill the mouse. You have to now go to the mikvah before you can eat those things. But it's only before you can eat those things. You don't have to walk around just because you killed a mouse. Doesn't mean you have to go to the mikvah that day. But you do, and wear the tea, right. So it depends. There's certain things.
When you put around your neck, you want a chain. So
right.
You did a great job.
Right, but that's why people had to say if they were an Am Ha'aretz or not. Because an Am Ha'aretz, by definition, wouldn't know when to put on the tea. So that's why somebody who had to be really careful would have to know if you're an Am Ha'aretz or not. So do I need to be careful? You might not know if you need to be wearing that tea or not. I need to be careful because I'm planning on going to the sanctuary today to offer something, right? Or this week. So I need to be very careful of you because I don't know. Because you don't know,
right?
But they're still, right?
Very
so
confusing.
It is confusing. Okay. So, right. So anyway, so hopefully I will learn more and share with you next week. The middle of Sukkot. So I just want to share with you one thought about Sukkot, just to remember while you're in your Sukkot. So everybody, we've shared this concept before, but I just want you to remember, first of all, it is Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, because we just went through this difficult time of being judged and then being forgiven, so it was a time of trepidation, but now it's a time of celebration. Our relationship is healed and whole, and now we get to celebrate. And the Sukkah, which halachically only requires 3 walls, has to look like this, it doesn't have to be closed, is shaped like a hug. So it is Hashem hugging us inside the sukkah, so we should feel that hug. But also the sukkah, the walls themselves, remind us of the Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory. And it is through the clouds of glory, they shined the light that we're supposed to absorb in order to be a light unto the nations. So we're like a glow-in-the-dark people, right? So we glow in the darkness of the surroundings around us. However, even glow-in-the-dark things have to get recharged. Right, you have to hold it up to the light. So that's what's happening in Sukkot. That's why we want to be in the sukkah as much as possible, because it's in the sukkah that we absorb that light so that we can glow all year long. So we want to make sure that we're in the sukkah as much as possible. And here is your riddle for the sukkah. What 2 mitzvot are the only mitzvot that you can be totally immersed in and your whole body functioning? Mikveh doesn't count because you can't breathe in the mikveh. Total immersion with your whole body functioning. Only 2.
Sukkah.
There's 1.
And living in the land of Israel. So there you go. So there's your, and so that's your sukkah question. And then your sukkah riddle is, what bracha do you make when you sit on bubblegum? Leishei bazooka.
Oh,
okay.